Riverward, they were engulfed by a mob of partygoers in festive hats or costumes, blowing noisemakers and snapping crackers. In the distance, Big Ben read a quarter past midnight, and the merrymaking was still cresting. Men whistled and shouted lewd advice when they saw Scrope hoisting high a shapely, calipigious girl in a flimsy nightgown, rear-end first through the throng. Imhotep towered behind. Perhaps his great height and outlandish costume, torn with bullet holes, would have attracted attention elsewhere. A man dressed as a teddy bear stared at him, and so did a teen in a neon-red afro. But no one else noticed. Scrope saw three faces he recognized, glimpsed in the crowd behind. Petrie, Youngblood, Lestrange. Then he saw two, then none. Manticore was pulling back. Unwilling to open fire on an inhuman target where eyes could see. That meant Monoceros was coming. Imhotep spoke.
"Release her. Your hands are unclean."
Scrope said,
"You release her. Undo this spell."
He put her down. She stood there, as empty-eyed as a waxwork doll.
"Oh, and for what reason should I do this thing?"
Imhotep smiled. Scrope popped the top button of his shirt, pulled on a fine gold chain, and drew out a small ivory figurine of a woman crowned with the moon. The circles beneath Imhotep's eyes grew darker as they wrinkled with sarcasm.
"Your charm may be potent to prevent me from stopping your heart with a mere gesture. It has no power to dismay me. Am I one of the lesser beings of the Dark World, that I should be stopped with an intersection of sticks, like some blood-drinking corpse?"
With a flip of his wrist, Scrope tossed the chain over Agnes's head. She drew in a breath, blinked, looked down at her semi-transparent nightgown, looked up at Imhotep, and screamed. Scrope seized and kissed her. He felt the tension drain out of her body. He drew his head back. Some of the yobs circling them whistled and clapped. Those gorgeous eyes were blazing with dark fire, and she said softly,
"Your grip is hurting me, but how do you have a grip?"
Imhotep said angrily,
"Unhand her. You demean the pure flesh of Ankhesenamon."
Scrope stepped back. Agnes gazed at the silver hand in awe. "Sorry," said Scrope. "This is, a prosthetic that... experimental, Imhotep said,
"He has drenched his soul in darkest magic, shamed to be a cripple before you. With murder he betrayed his masters, who commanded him to kill you."
Agnes said playfully,
"Universal Exports asked him to commit murder. They must be very serious about trade balance."
Imhotep dropped his voice and spoke with burning urgency.
"Many times he has deceived you. I have never, my princess."
She said scornfully,
"He never made me walk hypnotized through London in January in the snow, barefoot, nor tried to stab me with a behemoth horn."
"I would have revived you, shed of mortality as a snake sheds its skin."
She sniffed.
"You were equally sure the Pharaoh would guess nothing."
"I have sacrificed all things for you,"
protested Imhotep, his dark, sardonic face for the first time showing signs of helplessness, bewilderment.
"And if your all things are not enough? Ardeth, you are hopeless. Henry, give me your coat. Take me someplace warm. Did you think to bring a pair of shoes for me?"
Scrope doffed his coat and threw it over her shoulders. Eyes were turning toward them. He realized that both his holsters, one beneath each armpit, were visible to passers-by. He wondered what was wrong with the English,
that they would ignore a 4,000-year-old Egyptian necromancer standing in their midst, but stare aghast at an armed man. Scrope took Agnes's hand and wormed his way through the crowd, with Imhotep striding behind, cuffing partygoers out of his way. Scrope said over the clamour,
"Agnes, I've planned this out. There is a warehouse fronting the river not far from here, where I've had a boat ready. I have friends in Goa who can hide us."
She said, "Goa? It is filled with Nagas. You did not think to discuss the plans with me?"
He said, "It's the Official Secrets Act. My mouth was sealed. If I told, and they found out..."
She laughed. "What would have happened? What? We'd be running through the streets at midnight in the snow with a crazy dead Egyptian being hunted?"
Scrope saw a small green glitter flicker through the air. He turned his head. A dragonfly landed on Agnes's wanton black curls and twitched its forelegs. He released her hand and swatted at the insect, uttering a stream of curses.
She said, "Watch your language, Henry. There are mummies present."
The bug was lost to sight. More specks buzzed here and there. A ladybug on the back of a man's coat, a beetle perched on the rim of a dropped beer bottle, a cluster of bees flickering as they passed through the snowy light shed by a street lamp. The three worked their way to the crowd's edge, turned a corner, and were suddenly alone. They ran. Barefooted in the snow, Agnes could not keep pace. Imhotep picked her up and set her on his shoulder. Now Scrope scowled. They reached a narrow street. Frowning brick closed in on one side. A row of warehouses loomed on the other. Beyond them, the dark water of the Thames glittered. Suddenly, the street lamps and lights from windows died. From afar came the wide noise of a crowd roaring in dismay. Scrope said, MI-20 always creates a blackout, just before they strike.
Agnes said, Who exactly is coming?
Our first man is Criswell. He was stranded on North Sentinel Island, whose people are the last to have no contact with civilization. At least, not human civilization. The witch doctors forced a concoction of honey and larvae down his mouth and nose, and left him to die, eaten from the inside. Thanks to his study in Tibet, he made an agreement with the nest built in his lungs. He can command any insect, see through their eyes. Rains and winds impede him. The second of his team is Rabbi Ben Bezalel, who woke the golem, a living statue of clay. The third is Grendel. Agnes said,
Who?
Scrope said,
Don't you read the classics?
One of the descendants of Cain who survived the deluge, interbred with elves and ogres and evil phantoms, amphibious, very strong, charmed life, immune to fire and steel, blade and bullet. The Americans call him the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Agnes said, We are in luck. A thunderstorm is hitting us in a few minutes. A thunder snowstorm, I suppose.
She sat atop the shoulder of Imhotep, slender and small in the bulky overcoat, a look of innocent guilelessness on her features.
I heard it on the weather report. Earlier. It will help with the bug man.
There was a silent flash of lightning from a distant storm. In the momentary glare, three things could be seen. The first was a hulking shape in the street before them, dressed not very convincingly in an oversized trench coat with a bowler hat pulled low over its slab-like features. It stood bow-legged, and its ape-like arms fell below its knees. Slung from shoulder to hip was a voluminous blood-stained bag of lizard-like skins, pebbled with bright patterns of scales, all knitted together with gold thread. The other was behind them, closer. It was even less likely to pass for human. It was fully 9 feet tall, the brick-red face a scarred and half-melted ruin, and the skull was as pointed as a bishop's mitre. Its eyes were deep-set slits that ran from mid-brow, slanting down left and right to touch the corners of its mouth, giving it an aspect of ghastly misery. Its mouth was a crooked slot held shut with three iron staples running through lip and jaw. It had no chin, no neck. The skull rose directly from the shoulders. It wore dungarees and bulky sweatshirt. A knitted longshoreman's cap had been thrown across the horrid skull to disguise the shape. Above, a pitchy cloud of insects was pouring across the streets, murmuring, spreading. Scrope said, "That warehouse! Run!" Behind him, Imhotep ran down the dark street on silent steps, and the long hair of the girl on his shoulder was a banner. The slow golem was outdistanced, but Grendel grinned and charged on all fours, overcoat tails flapping. The dark man gently put Agnes down. His voice trembled.
"Should I perish? And if it be 1,000 years more, or 10,000, never will I cease to love you, my Unki Cinnamon. I shall return to you always."
So saying, he turned and fell upon Grendel, who reared up on hind legs to meet him. Scrope and Agnes ran on. A short concrete drive led to the warehouse. Before them was a large square garage door. He unlocked it. The wind was rising. The snow began to fall in pelting lines, mingled with icy rain. In the gloom behind them, two inhuman shapes grappled, cracking the pavement beneath their feet, scattering trash cans, smashing the red pillar of a postbox, and bending an unlit lamppost. Scrope pushed her inside. He pulled the heavy door shut and locked it. Agnes said,
"It is not cricket to leave him behind.
He will kill us as soon as..." Something was wrong. He turned, spooked. At the building rear was a boat slip that opened onto the Thames. It allowed boats to dock inside the warehouse and load cargo directly from the lofts overhead. A door of corrugated metal hung down between the river and the warehouse. There was a single beam of light coming down from the skylight. It was falling on a small, fast cigarette boat in the slip.
"We're sailing to India in that?" asked Agnes.
Scrope drew the H&K. He looked left and right, wondering what was setting his nerves on edge. "The yacht is in Calais. This is just to get us across the channel." Then he realized. That light was not coming from a lamp. A man was standing on the roof, looking down, torch in hand. Scrope shot a burst. He heard the noise of shattering glass and cursed himself for a fool. A buzzing filled the air. Down through the broken panes came a cloud of flying insects. He shot again, and the light went out. But the insects swarmed him, stinging at his eyes, trying to crawl into mouth and nose. He shoved Agnes toward the boat and ran up the creaking wooden staircase toward the door motor. He ran as fast as he could in the dark, his silver hand over his eyes, flight after flight, spitting. 100 hot needles stung his jaws and neck, his shirt, his ankles. Then he was at the top loft. He parted his metal fingers to peek. In the snowy moonlight, he saw no one on the roof. 30 feet below, Agnes, hidden in an insect cloud, ran toward the boat. She dove and vanished from sight, leaving behind a spreading pool of bugs on the surface. His left hand and face were beginning to stiffen and swell. Scrope turned on the door motor. It was not connected to the city power grid. It sputtered to life. The river door started to lift. Half the swarm fled Scrope and fell upon the engine, squeezing their bodies into the innards. It only took a pound of dead bugs crammed into the vents to choke it into silence. The doors halted 2 feet above the water, insufficient to let the boat escape. Scrope opened the door engine housing. A gush of fumes rose. The insects were startled and flew up. He had a moment before Criswell resumed control. There was an oil-soaked rag, large as a bath towel, near the engine. He tossed it over his head, an impromptu insect net, found a tear to peer through, and down the stairs he ran. He saw no sign of Agnes. How long could she hold her breath? He was on the second landing when a light appeared underfoot. Into view beneath him came a thin man in a wide-brimmed hat, dark sunglasses, an overcoat. He entered from the small door leading into the warehouse office. He carried a torch and a crowbar, but no pistol. A carpet of poisonous centipedes crawled after him in an endless train, along with scorpions and other deadly things. Criswell had descended the fire ladder connecting the office to the roof. Scrope raised his pistol, but the insects crawling on his hand warned Criswell, who doused his torch and threw the swarm into Scrope's face. The oily cloth on his head saved his eyes, but he did not have a shot. He heard the sound of Criswell crowbarring open the main doors. Scrope ran down the next flight of stairs to the first landing, half blind. A flash of lightning spilling in through the opening main door and the broken skylight painted the scene with jagged, leaping shadows. Grendel still wore the tatters of his vast overcoat and the crushed shape of his bowler hat. His face was streaked with blood, and he was breathing heavily between his white, sharp teeth. Impatiently he forced the doors open, yanking them from their tracks. Behind him was Imhotep, limp as if his bones were broken, in the grip of the freakish, cone-skulled, 9-foot-tall statue man. Imhotep did not bleed blood. Instead, a thick, black oil was dripping from him. Next to the golem was a short, fat little man in osprey armor, and on his back a flamethrower, and in his hand a golden scroll. Scrope recognized him as Rabbi Ben Bezalel. Criswell pointed at the water, made a gesture in sign language. Grendel loped across the concrete floor and dove. Criswell then snapped his fingers at the rabbi and pointed at where Scrope crouched on the first landing in the pitch dark. Scrope shot at Criswell, but missed. The thin man did not even flinch as bullets ricocheted from the concrete at his feet. The rabbi sprayed his flamethrower against the base of the wooden staircase and then up the stairs halfway to the first landing. Black smoke rolled upward, and the heat was like a bludgeon. Scrope shot a burst into the rabbi, igniting the flamethrower canister. The chubby man ran, trying to flee his burning back, shrieking for help, clawing at the shoulder straps. Responding literally to his master's call, the golem dropped Imhotep. It lumbered over to where Rabbi Ben Bezalel was twisting in a pool of napalm, burning, and bent over the charred, still-moving body solicitously.
"Avenge me!"
Grendel leapt free of the water, Agnes writhing in his grip, the slick coat and sheer nightgown clinging to her. Scrope held his breath, ran down the burning stairs. The smoke drove the insects from him, but the heat was burning through his boots, and his silver arm grew hot. Imhotep's voice rang out over the wind of the gathering storm.
"Let two hands from the earth open my mouth. Let Seb, the Erpa of the gods, part my two jaws. Let him open my two eyes which are closed, and give motion to my two hands which are powerless. and let Anubis give vigor to my legs, that I may raise myself up upon them. Be there, given to me, my mouth, wherewith to speak, and my feet for walking, and let me have my arms wherewith to overthrow my adversaries. And may Sechit, the Divine One, lift me up.
And through the driving snow, the dead man stood, and a thunderclap echoed from the heavens. Scrope fell back from the heat. It did not seem fair that the mummy could raise himself from the dead, and Scrope could not even get downstairs. The flames parted. The woe-eyed golem came toward Scrope up the burning stairs, slowly, methodically, unstoppably. Scrope retreated, but the stairs behind him collapsed with a roar and a storm of flying sparks. He fired his six remaining bullets point blank into the sad, ruined, worn clay face of the lifeless monster. The golem clasped him. He felt his ribs bending and knew he was about to die. He also knew the weakness of the golem. The Kabbalistic letters forming the secret name of Truth were written somewhere on its head. But where? Agnes screamed. Imhotep had rescued the girl from the hands of Grendel and was driving the quaking amphibious man backward merely with the pressure of his gaze. Grendel closed his eyes and lunged. The two figures wrestled with superhuman strength. They fell into the spreading pool of napalm. The stairs beneath the golem's feet, eaten by fire, gave way. The golem fell a dozen feet, clutching Scrope. The fall jarred the golem's grip, and Scrope managed to tear his silver arm free. He battered at the triangular, woe-begone face, making dents like a sledgehammer would, but the spectacular damage he had done to metal bars and doors eluded him. The magic arm had no power over clay, but the three clamps holding the mouth shut were metal. He pried the first clamp up with his silver fingers with a snap. The golem tightened his grip. Scrope's vision faded into a haze of red. Snap! The second clamp broke. He could no longer hear the roar of the storm, no longer feel the heat from the burning building. Snap! He was sure it was his bones breaking. His silver hand pried the scowling, lipless mouth open and gripped the tongue. In the wobbly, red haze of his vision, he could see the Kabbalistic letters printed on it. The golem did not notice or care. It was carrying out its master's last order obediently, mindlessly. With the thumbnail of his living hand, Scrope scratched out the letter Aleph. Emmet became Met, the word for death. Instantly, the statue perished. He was trapped in the motionless arms. He pounded at the clay hands. Imhotep, even with his back and one arm afire, was besting Grendel. With immense strength, the dark man threw Grendel spine first onto a jagged stump in the midst of the burning lumber pile that had once been the staircase. Storm winds through the broken doors fanned the flames. Grendel fell. He groaned and clawed his way through the oily flames, dragging his limp and motionless legs behind him. Imhotep now turned toward Criswell, and the light in the eyes of the Egyptian was truly a nightmarish thing. Criswell had lost his hat, but not his sunglasses. He clutched Agnes and hid behind her, backing carefully toward the boat. The swarms of insects closed on Imhotep, but the flames from the dry and burning body prevented them from landing. The Egyptian trod scorpions, unhurt. Agnes worked one arm free, reached behind her, and clawed Criswell's face. His sunglasses broke. The two empty eye sockets were filled with the grey, papery substance of wasps' nests, and half a dozen queen wasps flew up from the vacant pits. A scream rent the air. It was not her scream, however. With her pinned arm, Agnes had at the same time drawn from the overcoat she wore the black injector shaped like a fountain pen Scrope had left in the pocket. She flicked open the needle and drove it into the large muscle in Criswell's thigh. A mix of holy water and deadly toxins entered him. Wasps issued from his open mouth as he screamed. His feet slipped, and he fell into the water. She fell with him. Frantic, Scrope broke off one of the clay fingers, then another. He was almost free. Imhotep lumbered toward the water, staggering and being eaten by the flames.
"My love will never die. Never. The whole dome of the sky will crack and topple to a withered, lifeless earth before I surrender her."
All the insects in the warehouse were directionless, dispersing. Agnes had not surfaced. There were no bubbles, no motion in the water. Grendel, by his right claw, pulled himself free of the oily flames. He was burned across his face and body. It seemed impossible that he still lived. But he held the same gold foil scroll that the rabbi earlier had carried. It was red hot, and Grendel's fingers sizzled when he unrolled it. Imhotep dove into the waters, quelling his burning back. His skin grew dark and heavy and seemed to sag, but he was too buoyant to force himself below the waters.
"Ankh-Senimon! Ankh-Senimon! I will find you. Even if you are drowned, I will revive you. You shall be with me, ever living, undying, greater than the gods themselves."
Grendel held up the scroll and spoke. His voice was a nasty, gargling croak, but the words were clear.
"In the name of Isis, I call upon the river god of Thames, Nordens, to protect against this blasphemer of the mysteries. Let him be overthrown and slaughtered. His abode is transferred to the slaughtering block of the east. His head is cut away. His neck is crushed, his thighs lopped off. He is given to the great annihilator who resideth in the valley that he may not ever escape from under the custody of Seb. Come, thou crocodile of the west, who livest on the setting stars. Come, thou crocodile of the east, who livest upon those who devour their own foulness. Come, thou crocodile of the south, who livest upon impurities. Come, thou crocodile of the north, who livest upon that which lieth between the hours."
Four 12-foot-long greenish shapes, like crocodiles, but bearing skents of gold and red gold on their narrow skulls, surfaced in the waters and eyed Imhotep with strange, cruel eyes.
"Ankh-Senimon!"
Imhotep called out in a great voice.
"Do not again forget me. Of all the torments of hell, that is the worst." "Is it?"
said a deep voice from the deep waters.
"Come, we shall see."
And the four crowned crocodiles seized the arms and legs of Imhotep in their teeth and, spinning, ripped his limbs from him. The black oil he used for blood spread across the water. A whirlpool formed beneath him, and the waters swallowed the dismembered man. Grendel was now crawling, arm over arm, to where Scrope was still pinned and motionless. The monster was no more than 4 yards away.
The Jew told me to do that, in case he failed.
3 yards. Scrope battered frantically at the dead hands holding him. Scrope twisted and pulled, but he was caught fast. 2 yards. Grendel's claws scrabbled against the concrete. Scrope could already see the blisters sinking on the monster, the third-degree burns vanishing.
You wish your limbs grew back, son of Seth, do you not? But you are not a son of Cain, and you do not have the art. Of all these wounds, I shall heal and forget, and dance beneath the waves with the Nicols and Sirens. But you shall die. I will eat your brain like cabbage.
Scrope pulled with all the strength of his silver arm, and an immense pain shot down from his right shoulder. He had dislocated it. Desperate, he twisted in the statue's grip and drew his Webley. The creature saw the gun.
"Why, Madhouse Harry, are you going to stick your hand down my throat and fire? I will tell everyone in the department how bold you were up to the last."
1 yard away, the creature reared up, drew back its great claw. Scrope fired point blank into the thing's broad chest. The creature flinched and then laughed. But the laughter turned into a long, dry, hideous sucking sound.
"Damn you!" croaked the monster. "It is Dr. Serizawa's oxygen destroyer. Only against the blood of the sea people does it do harm. How did you?"
His skin crinkled and flattened on his bones, as if a great vacuum were inside him. His eyes curled up like raisins. His tongue became a thin lash of flesh. His lips lost their hue. He collapsed inward on himself. The fire was spreading. Scrope pried himself loose from Grendel's grip. Smoke filled the warehouse. Agnes had not surfaced. The corpse of Criswell was floating in the water, being busily devoured by his own insects. The winds howled, and the snow and hail poured through the broken skylight. He hoped he would find her outside. Surely she slid away to safety under the waters. His shoulder was a fiery vice grip of pain where he had dislocated it, and his feet were so blistered with burns that he could barely stand, but by sheer force of will he made the silver arm rise up and shatter the sea doors. Pain shot through his whole body, and for a moment he collapsed, staring upward at the hailstones ringing through the broken skylight, at the black smoke pouring up and out. Wearily, he crawled along the lip of the concrete quay. He had to keep telling himself that if he dove in the water, the 60-pound weight of the arm would drag him under. He passed the body of Grendel. He carefully twisted, then tore the head free. It was dry and crumbling, and he lugged it along by the hair. Painfully, slowly, he undid the boat lines. Painfully, slowly, he boarded and crawled aft and spun the engines to life, glad they were not clogged with dead wasps. The slim boat slid out onto the Thames. The city was dark. The storm was fierce, but the wind was blowing out to sea at his back. Shivering in the hail, he wished he had his jacket. He wished he had bullets. He wished a lot of things. The wild winds blew the clouds free of the moon, and in that pallid light he saw the ship. Crewed by thin and famished men, and some of them were dead, and some of the dead were skeletons, was the great three-masted clipper, her canvas sails torn and flapping, her hull crusted with barnacles. Something splashed behind him. Agnes was there, her arms, shoulders, and head coming up out of the water and over the gunwale of the boat. She was nude, and her long black hair clung tightly to her skull and shoulders. Her eyes were beautiful, chatoyant, and were of a dark and deeper hue than he had ever seen before. He was afraid to step across the boat to her. She cocked her head to one side, smiling. He said, "My coat?" She said, "I did not really need it, but I thank you for the gesture. We don't get cold." He just nodded. "Why did you do it?" She said, "Because when you knelt and offered me a little square black box, I knew what it was supposed to hold. It was supposed to have a ring inside, a wedding ring. Instead, it was your flat key. We did not exchange vows. We exchanged keys." He felt a pounding in his head. Perhaps it was the combination of burns, dislocations, evil magic, bee stings, and a general adrenaline overdose. Perhaps it was the typical frustration of a man talking to a woman. What the hell are you talking about, Agnes?
My name is Aglaope. Aglaope Vanderdecken.
I wanted to know why you chose me.
Your crazy bravery. And you were in Cairo. I needed someone crazy to protect me from Imhotep. What were his last words?
Is that why you came back here? Not to have a last word with me? She giggled.
My last word with you is to ask what Imhotep said when he was carried alive to hell by a pep.
But why didn't you ever tell you?
She merely smiled, and his words caught in his throat.
I was sent by the ruler of my people, Her Highness Aquarena, to spy out Manticore and your doings, because of late you grow ruthless in hunting us down, Unseelie and Seelie both. Other realms soon intersect with Earth. Ancient gates will open, even we wish kept shut. I was sent to see whether you could be reasoned with. You cannot. You don't know your own hearts. Your superiors at MI4 assumed you knew I was only half-human, and wanted me that way. I become a mortal woman if a man weds me in a church, and would bear him strong sons and fair daughters.
Half-human?
She pointed. He thought he had never seen an arm so fair, so well-shaped.
My father is the captain of that ship, which sailed into the night world long ago, forsaking yours. My mother is Princess Clea, who took him in her arms to comfort him. From the union sprang a porpoise and a sea bream, and the other was me. The great god of your world blows the winds against him whenever he tries to make port. I sent a signal to him earlier, asking him to come up the Thames. See how simple? It is like having a storm in your pouch. It will cover my retreat.
She heaved herself up on her arms, so that her belly was at her elbow, and her naked, wet, shining breasts were visible. Between them hung the charm of Isis. She pouted and pointed at it with her chin.
May I keep this? I want to remember Imhotep, and things of your world are easy to forget. What were his last words?
He said his love for you will never die, even if the sky falls and earth perishes. Or something like that. He said your forgetting him was worse than all the pains of hell. She smiled sadly.
Ah, did he? Well, my sisters will honor me for that.
You lure sailors to their deaths, do you?
Had you lured me to life, dear Henry, I would have stayed. Something is more important to you than I was. What? What do you hold sacred?
She shook her head.
We are not luring men out of the mortal world to kill them, you know. We need fighters when the time comes, and you humans are the deadliest monsters of all. But we change them. They can never go home again. Sunlight kills them.
She nodded at the silver hand.
You know, like that. My sisters will honor me for your death, too. You put on that deadly arm for me, didn't you? How sweet. But Imhotep was serious. You were not. A flat key. Imagine. And me the reincarnation of a pharaoh's daughter.
She smiled dismissively.
Him I shall miss. You I shall forget.
She slipped down and sped across the dark and stormy waters more swiftly and gracefully than a dolphin toward the dark, tattered ghost ship. By the time he reached the English Channel, the black ship was gone, and so was the storm. The sky was pink with coming dawn, and the jolts of pain running down his silver arm to his heart were growing stronger. He took out the severed head of Grendel, inserted the small round stone into the dead man's mouth, and spoke the words. This time, they did not burn his throat. The eyes opened.
I see a mortal man who has no claim on me. Our debts are paid, each to the other.
I propose a new bargain. You are not at peace by any means, are you? You have monsters you need hunted. I am skilled in the work, and I have it on good authority that we men are the deadliest monsters there are. The lifeless head twisted its lips into a smile.
You wish me to be your lord? Ah, but by what name would we swear our oaths of loyalty and fealty?
There is one thing I hold sacred. Any monster I kill for you is one less to menace the innocent. I gave up everything for my profession, even love. Some men are wolves and must prey on the weak. Most men are sheep and never look up from the grass they graze. I am a wolfhound, and I prey on the strong. I hunt the horrors. I swear by monster hunting. Perhaps the dark voice laughed.
Then come. Say farewell to sun. I open the jaws of night to you, and bring you living to my court of darkness.
The boat was later found by the Coast Guard, drifting, empty. Trip Jones was picked for MHI's best team right out of training for a reason. He's a skilled hunter. But more importantly, the man's got a bigger heart than the rest of us put together. A.L. The Dead Yard. Maurice Broaddus. When monsters want to feed, they went after the poor and the powerless first. The longer I've been with Monster Hunter International, the more true I believe this to be. What was worse, those monsters came in all shapes and sizes. I splashed water on my face before leaning heavily on the sink. I took a long, hard look in the hotel mirror. How are you doing, Mr. John Jermaine Jones? Triple J to some. Trip to friends and family. I could always tell how I knew a person by what they called me. I zipped up my suitcase. I never bothered to unpack it at a hotel or on any mission. I hated the feeling of settling in only to uproot myself again. My family used to be fishermen in Jamaica, but immigrated to America a few generations ago. They made a life for themselves, but we never forgot where we came from. There was a Jewish teaching that always stuck with me. Tikkun Olam, repairing the world, the damage done by myself and others, healing the broken pieces as a way of life. It was what led me to go into teaching high school chemistry. It was also what led me to pick up a pickaxe when a zombie outbreak occurred. That was the way my world worked down. In the end, I just wanted to make a difference, keep my family safe. So when word came to MHI about a series of killings on the island, I felt a strange, familial tug to lead the investigation team. A small team of people I trust with my life, Owen Zastava Pitt and Holly Newcastle. Family took care of family. A young man claiming to be a distant cousin who kept greeting me as Brother Jones ran the Sandals Resort in Montego Bay. I wanted my friends to enjoy themselves, a moment in the sun before we got down to business, so my cousin comped us a night. A blast of heat let me know I was leaving the confines of the hotel lobby to enter the beachfront. The entire beach line was a series of cordoned-off resorts. Tourism was the lifeblood of the island, with tourists arriving, shedding their old lives, and doing things they wouldn't dare back home. I knew where I'd find Owen. Under the canopy of an open-air bar, shifting in his seat, never quite comfortable in his own skin. Owen was one of them dudes you'd mistake for being a jock type, and never peg as having been an accountant before hooking up with MHI. That was kind of his thing. Never quite being what people expected.
"What's that?"
Owen stared at the beverage in his glass, an umbrella tilted to the side like an assassin poised to strike. "An umbrella?"
"The bartender insisted that I try it. Wanted to give me a taste of the island. I'm not sure I trust any drink with an umbrella in it."
Owen turned his hulking frame, fully revealing the scar on his face. My dad used to love this show called The Rockford Files. He told me what he loved was how the main detective got his butt kicked so often while working on a case. That was Owen's go-to move in a nutshell, putting himself between danger and innocence. The scar was only one of his souvenirs from doing so.
"Everything okay, Trip?"
"Yeah, why?"
"You look like you're carrying the weight of the world's problems. You know, more than usual."
"Thanks. I'll be okay." I glanced around. "Where's Holly?"
Taking point on tactical surveillance."
Taking a sip, nodding approvingly at the glass before carrying it with him, Owen led the way to the pool. Wearing a black and white striped bikini, Holly floated on an inflatable mattress. She raised her sunglasses when she saw us. "Getting a taste of resort Jamaica before we get to real Jamaica?" I asked. "This is real enough for me." She eased back into her air mattress to bask in the sun. All blonde-haired and blue-eyed, she had a swimsuit model's body, and knew it. She didn't care how people gawked at her, since she was once a stripper in Las Vegas. She had this fierce sense of self and a will nearly as strong as Owen's. Not that I'd ever tell her, but I'd always admired how she carried herself as a hunter. By the time I realized I was staring, Holly met my eyes.
"Never seen a woman in a bikini before?"
"This is the kind of hunt we need to do more often,"
Owen interrupted to rescue me from an awkward moment.
"What are we looking at?"
The series of murders had been localized to a single parish just outside of Mo Bay, I said.
"Mo Bay?" Holly asked.
"That's what the locals call Montego Bay," I said.
"You couldn't sound any more like a tourist if you tried," Owen said.
"I still feel a connection to this place. My mother used to tell me stories her mother passed on to her about this place. You know how kids are. After a certain age, you just tune out your parents' voice. As I got older, I realized I had no stories to tell them."
"I bet you have some now," Owen said.
"Not if I'm actually trying to get them to sleep." I scanned the area for potential eavesdroppers. "My aunt is the Justice of the Peace of the St. James Parish. Her family, our family, is hosting the Nine Nights."
"Nine Nights?" Holly asked.
"Think of it as an extended Irish wake. Some people still refer to it as the Dead Yard. The latest victim was a baby. 9 days old. Drained dry. Emotions are running high, so the Nine Nights has been closed to just family. She invited me and my family to come stay with her." I turned to Owen. "Though she wasn't real receptive to the idea of me bringing a friend."
"Wait. Holly sat up like a student still working out a math problem. When you say family, she wanted to meet Mrs. Jones. I avoided her eyes.
Ha! Owen snorted. This mission just gets better and better.
Whose idea was this?
Holly crossed her arms.
Apparently my aunt is very traditional, so having Owen as my wife was out. Why would I be the wife?
Owen asked.
Because it's my story. So if a woman was going to come along, she'd have to be someone's wife in order to be under her roof, as she put it.
So, your cover would be either Mrs. John Jermaine Jones, or...
Owen held out his arms and started humming a wedding march. It's like choosing between the lesser of two evils, Holly said.
What do they think it is?
Owen asked.
Barurigaru, Chupacabra, Vampire, Lugaru.
When you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. Our best guess is we're looking at some sort of undead. I was still settling into the idea of being in charge of the mission. Because it was family, Earl wanted me to lead it. Part of me enjoyed the way they turned to me as leader. Owen especially. Owen didn't do well with authority or anyone telling him what to do. But he listened to his friends. Officially, we were called in as a favor to a government official.
Favor? Not to sound too crass, but favors don't pay the bills, Owen said.
Did I mention the victims were 9 days old? Besides, as I understand it, my aunt is paying the equivalent of the puff herself. The Perpetual Unearthly Forces Fund was the government-issued cash bounty for monsters. Since the puff didn't apply out of country, someone had to foot the bills. This was a job, not a calling after all, and it didn't get done cheap.
So they want a low-key investigation. Is that all?
It's just, this one is personal.
This time it's personal?
Holly lowered her glasses.
Buy me whatever Owen's drinking, Trip, and I'll let that line go.
When we exited the resort, a taxi driver snapped to attention. A bowler hat with feathers stuck in it topped his grizzled dreadlocks. Yellowed, bloodshot eyes tracked us. A strikingly well-trimmed silver mustache framed two rows of perfectly white teeth. Hard-scrabble hands waved us over.
You Jones?
Yeah, I stepped forward.
You are Rasta?
Pulling a cigarette from his mouth, he ground it out under his heel as he studied my dreadlocks.
No, it's just my hair.
The man made a non-committal noise.
Come on, I have the rest of your luggage already loaded.
Any trouble with customs? I asked.
Not if you know the right people.
The driver half sneered at me.
Why have you come here?
Ignoring the challenge in his voice, like I was some unwanted trespasser, I dropped into the passenger seat. We were asked, come to investigate some deaths under mysterious circumstances.
You Americans don't think we can handle our own business. You people come and stare and make fun, like we're exhibits at a zoo for your entertainment.
I have family here. We were called in to help, not take over.
Then you're hunting your heritage.
The taxi sped by a billboard which read, Don't be in a hurry to enter eternity. Armed police stopped traffic at a roadside check. We were officially leaving Resort Jamaica. I leaned forward to catch the eye of the taxi driver.
No problem, no problem.
The driver wound his hands like he was patting down the air. One of the men pointed at Owen and demanded that he open his bag. Owen complied, revealing several shirts with loud prints on them, toiletries, and a magazine. Disappointed, the police officer waved us through. The drive up the mountain gave a perfect view of the parish, a tableau of green hills covered by low-lying clouds, a series of potholes and edges which bled into a scree of crumbling asphalt. The road was barely wide enough to allow two cars to pass.
The taxi driver stayed in the middle, honking his way around the blind curves. Only if another vehicle honked in response did he drift into his proper lane.
"I've flown in helicopters through enemy fire that was safer than this," Holly said.
"How much longer?" I asked.
"Soon come," the driver said. "Just around the corner."
Couple miles later, we stopped in front of a house. Concrete walls surrounded the property, 7 feet high, topped with razor wire. Metal gates jerked open. The long driveway took us past an intricate garden filled with banana, coconut, breadfruit trees, along with rows of corn, tomatoes, and vegetables I didn't recognize. The main house was a pastel castle, with its thick turquoise walls trimmed with a pink and red tiled roof. Metal grating, painted white, enclosed the portico. Each window fitted with burglar bars, wrought iron bars fixed to the exterior, gave the house the appearance of a prison. At least they were painted white to match the portico.
"Mind if I check my bags?"
Owen stepped out of the taxi.
"No one trouble you, stuff man."
The driver walked to the rear of the car and popped the trunk. Owen opened the top chest. A couple of Jericho pistols, a Beretta 1301 tactical, a gas piston-operated semi-automatic 12-gauge shotgun, Tavor assault rifles, a Negev machine gun, magazines of ammunition. Not our usual gear, but since we were operating in another country, we didn't know what might get caught up in customs, or was legal, or what we'd have to ditch on short notice. Owen strapped a Jericho to his hip and exhaled as if he'd been holding his breath the whole time.
"I just wanted to make sure none of our equipment grew legs." "Tourists. All you see are bitches and criminals. We live in between," the driver said.
"What do you think?"
A short woman, 5'4" tops, with recently dyed reddish-brown hair, swept her arms out as if she were responsible for the view. Straight-backed, she carried herself with authority.
"Senior Justice of the Peace, Carmen Hicks.
It's so good to meet you." I hunched over awkwardly to give her a hug. A lot stronger than she appeared, she hugged me tight and kissed me on the cheek.
"I've been telling all of my people that we have important family coming from the States to stay with us. And who is this beautiful girl?"
"This is Holly, my wife." I laced my fingers into hers. She squeezed my fingers as if locking them in a steel trap so they wouldn't wander.
"Come here. Let me take a look at you."
Brushing my hand aside like she swatted at a fly, Carmen took each of Holly's hands and held them out better to inspect her.
"I have such a beautiful niece."
"Thank you,"
Holly said through clenched teeth, half glaring at me. "And this is my friend Owen." I stepped aside. Letting go of Holly's hands, Carmen scarcely spared a glance in Owen's direction.
"Yes, he can stay around back with Lord Evader. Come, let me show you around."
Entering through a mosquito-screened door, a blast from an air curtain hit them. A wide-screened HDTV filled the back wall and sat next to the array of boxes of her Wi-Fi and satellite connections. Doilies and knick-knacks covered each end table and shelf surface with an elderly British mum's fussy sense of decor. Sheets of plastic covered the furniture and similar strips ran along the main walkways. Owen sat down, his chair sounding like it passed gas. He squeaked against the plastic, attempting to settle in. Carmen insisted that Holly and I take the love seat while she stood. She barked at a maid to fetch a tray of a drink called sorrel. The maid disappeared through a door leading to the kitchen. A group of women sat around huge metal pots filled with bubbling rice. A series of pots held what smelled to be curried goat simmering on the stove. Trays and trays full of jerk chicken lined the counters.
The driver leaned a stack of crates along a dolly, wheeling bottles of rum through to another room. Eyeing them, the man closed the door behind him. "Quite the party you're preparing for," Owen said.